Good morning, everyone. I think we'll get started. On behalf of USIP, the Jennings Randolph Program in particular, as well as the American Society of International Law, I'd like to welcome you all here this morning. My name is Lynn Tesser. I'm a program officer in the Jennings Randolph Program. I'm one of the organizers of this event and also will be serving as the moderator today. And we're delighted to bring you an absolutely first-rate panel on the UN to consider, in particular, the increase of decision-making on conflict and post-conflict issues in the post-Cold War period. I think it's hard to think of three better people to bring to you today, not only because of their vast experience and expertise, but also because of, I think, the likelihood that they'll give us three different perspectives on the topic at hand. And so I'll wager that we'll have a pretty good debate here this morning. So we welcome that. The panel has been convened not only to consider the UN, the expansion of its legal authority, but to also mark the recent release of Professor Michael Matheson's new book, published, of course, by USIP Press, called Council Unbound, The Growth of UN Decision-Making on Conflict and Post-Conflict Issues After the Cold War. Now, Professor Matheson was a senior fellow here at USIP, and, of course, we'd like to welcome him back and to congratulate him on the completion of a book that I think once you read it, you'll agree is extraordinarily useful and very timely. We'd like to honor him today for the time and effort put into the book and, again, one that helps us to appreciate some recent changes and developments that we might not have otherwise paid attention to. Now, USIP, I think as some of you know, has been involved in issues of UN reform, particularly after Congress asked the Institute to create a task force on the UN, one which produced a report that was, I think, quite well received in the foreign policy community. Now, the Jennings Randolph Program has also been very much involved in producing materials, books in particular, on key international institutions like the UN, particularly in the post-Cold War period. I can think of, for example, Henrik, in addition to Professor Matheson's book, Henrik Sokolsky's book on the UN mission in Macedonia, which was the first UN preventative peacekeeping mission, book entitled An Ounce of Prevention, Macedonia and the UN Experience in Preventative Diplomacy. Another would be David Yost's book on NATO's new roles in international security in the post-Cold War world, entitled NATO Transformed, the Alliance's New Roles in International Security, both published by USIP Press. Now, while I think our three panelists probably need no introduction in this town, nevertheless, I'd like to say a few words about their present affiliations and some of their key achievements. First of all, of course, we have Professor Michael Matheson. Mike, at present, is a member of the International Law Faculty at George Washington University School of Law. He's a former deputy legal advisor at the State Department. While there, he led efforts to create the International Criminal Tribunals for Yugoslavia and Rwanda, as well as the UN Compensation Commission for Gulf War Claims. He's also served as a member of the UN International Law Commission and has argued many cases before international tribunals, including the International Court of Justice. Next, we have Professor Ruth Wedgwood. Ruth, at present, is the Edward B. Burling Professor of International Law and Diplomacy and the Director of the International Law and Organization Program at CICE, Johns Hopkins University. She's been a member of the UN Human Rights Committee, the U.S. Secretary of State's Advisory Committee for International Law, has served as an independent expert for the ICTY, among other notable positions. A former professor at Yale Law School, she has also been a senior fellow at the Council of Foreign Relations and has served as a chief of staff to the head of the Criminal Division of the Department of Justice. Now, last but certainly not least, we have Ambassador Jacques Klein. Jacques, at present, is a member of the Public and International Affairs Faculty at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. He's former chief of UN operations in Croatia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, and Liberia. He's also held a number of positions at the U.S. Departments of State and Defense and has served as a political advisor to the commander-in-chief of the U.S.-European Command in Stuttgart. And Klein is also the recipient of numerous awards from academia, the Departments of State and Defense, among others. And finally, I'd just like to say a few words about Soren Jessen Peterson, presently guest scholar at USIP and former head of UNMIC, who was originally scheduled to appear on this panel today, but unfortunately will not be able to come. I have discussed the book with Soren, and he's given me some ideas to try and interject into our panel discussion later on this morning. So I'll try and let those of you who came, especially here, Soren, let you know some of his thoughts when the opportunity presents itself. So now, in terms of how we'll proceed, Mike will start us off with talk on the book and, of course, the topic, followed by comments from Ruth and then Jacques. I will then throw in a couple of questions to get the panel talking a bit more before opening up for questions and comments from the audience. When we do open up to the audience, we ask those of you who would like to make a question or comment to please use the microphones on the side of the room. And then one final plea to ask everyone to turn off their cell phones so that we have no interference with our microphone system. So we very much appreciate if you could turn off your cell phones. So with that, appropriately, we'll get started with Mike. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for that very kind introduction. Appreciate it. And, of course, thanks both to the Institute and the American Society for hosting this session today. Needless to say, I'm very grateful to the Institute for having had the opportunity to spend a year here researching and writing this book, and in particular to those individuals who helped me out during the process. John Christ is here. Is Peter Pavlionis here, my editor? Well, at any rate, I thank him as well in absentia. What I want to do in my time is basically to give you an overview of the basic themes and substance of the book, following which I'm sure the other members of the panel will tell you how I got it all wrong, and then we'll be glad to have plenty of time to hear your comments and questions on specific issues. Basically, what the book is an attempt by me to catalog and analyze the great expansion that occurred during the post-Cold War period in the exercise of authority by the Security Council, legal authority, but as a result, political authority as well. Now, I know there are some serious scholars of international law here, but I'm not going to assume that everybody is, nor am I going to assume everybody's read the book, though I do hope in due course you'll have a chance to do that. Let me start with just a few words about the basic framework under which the Security Council operates under the UN Charter. You may know that prior to the 20th century, there were essentially no limits in international law, or very few limits, on the degree to which states could use force to accomplish their political objectives. But after the trauma of the two world wars, the international community was determined to create a new structure that would give some real hope of some kind of control on armed conflict and some means of dealing with the aftermath of armed conflict. And so you see that framework in the UN Charter. We start with the prohibition in Article 2 on the use of force by one state against the territorial integrity or political independence of another state or in any other manner contrary to the purposes of the UN. And then in later chapters, we see the grant of great powers to the Security Council. In Chapter 6, powers to make non-mandatory steps for situations that have not yet become a threat to the peace. And then in Chapter 7, a variety of important mandatory powers whenever the Security Council finds that a threat to the peace has emerged. And these powers, of course, include not only economic and diplomatic sanctions, but the authority to authorize the use of force. In principle, this is a very effective structure. But obviously, it depends upon there being a degree of consensus among the members of the Council, particularly among the permanent five, each of whom have a veto. And during the Cold War, this was largely lacking, with the result that this great authority of the Council in the Charter remained pretty much dormant during the first 45 years of the existence of the UN. But with the end of the Cold War, there came an easing of these political confrontations and differences of interest, which made possible a much wider use of this latent authority and in many new and creative ways. One key to all of this was the fact that the Council adopted a much expanded view of its own jurisdiction, as I've said, to use Chapter 7 authorities, the Council has to find that there's a threat to the peace. And prior to the end of the Cold War, there was a considerable reluctance by the Council to find a threat to the peace in situations where there was no clear threat of actual conflict between states. But in the early 90s, there came a great expansion in this concept of the Council's jurisdiction. After the Gulf War, the Council found that there was a threat to the peace in Iraqi repression of the Kurds and Shia, and also a threat to the peace in the humanitarian catastrophe in Somalia, and in the overthrow of democratic governments in Haiti and Sierra Leone, and then in a series of conflicts of internal in character in Africa. During the early years, there was a lot of hesitation and doubt in some parts of the Council as to whether this was lawful or appropriate. But by the end of the decade, I think it became accepted that there were many factors which might cause an internal situation to become a legitimate object of a determination that a threat to the peace occurred. For example, the possibility of significant refugee flows across a border, or the possibility of ethnic conflict going across national boundaries, or very severe human rights violations, or very severe humanitarian catastrophe, or threats to democracy that might destabilize a region politically. All of these things came to be recognized as appropriate bases for the Council to use its Chapter 7 authority, which meant that the Security Council now could become an instrument for forcible international intervention into a wide range of situations to deal with a wide range of problems. And there was a further expansion in this concept in the early years of this millennium with respect to threats that were not limited to a particular situation, but which were generic in character, worldwide in character. In particular, after 9/11, the Council determined that the overall international terrorism situation was a threat to the peace, and adopted measures that applied worldwide with respect to international terrorist activities. And the same thing happened a couple of years ago with respect to the problem of the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction to non-state entities, where the Council decided that that worldwide phenomenon was a threat to the peace, justifying Chapter 7 action. So now, what did the Security Council do with this expanded notion of its own jurisdiction? We'll start with sanctions. Of course, sanctions are not a new idea. They were have long been recognized as a sort of an intermediate step between traditional diplomacy and the application of armed force. During the Cold War, there was a somewhat hesitant application of sanctions by the Council, but there was a great acceleration in the use of international sanctions at the end of the Cold War, which resulted both in the development of new techniques and tools for the use of sanctions, but also in the emergence of a set of new problems which have not been completely resolved. After the Iraq invasion of Kuwait, the Council imposed immediately comprehensive economic sanctions against Iraq. With respect to Yugoslavia and Haiti, the Council started by imposing partial sanctions, then increased them to comprehensive sanctions, and then ratcheted them up and down depending upon the degree to which the regimes in question were complying with Council demands. During the course of this, the Council developed new enforcement tools to enforce these sanctions, including the coordination of national financial controls, maritime and air interdiction, secondary sanctions on countries that were not complying with their sanctions duties, the creation of committees of the Council to determine the specific application of sanctions in particular cases, and also to coordinate national enforcement. But there was a persistent problem throughout this period in the use of these sanctions with respect to the possible collateral damage that sanctions might cause to states or to civilian populations that were not the direct object of sanctions. For example, the comprehensive sanctions in Iraq and Yugoslavia and Haiti were often criticized as causing unnecessary civilian suffering or unnecessary damage to neighboring states. And over the course of the decade, the Council began to develop different techniques to try and mitigate to some extent the effect of sanctions on these collateral populations and states. For example, the Council began to adopt what it called targeted or smart sanctions, that is to say, directed against specific leadership elites or specific economic sectors. Develop humanitarian exceptions to the trade sanctions. In the case of Iraq, the creation of a very large fund to purchase humanitarian supplies for the Iraqi population. All of these necessary steps, desirable steps, but of course we have to remember that they're will probably be situations in which sanctions need to be relatively comprehensive, in which it will be possible to mitigate but certainly not to eliminate the collateral damage, and that this, like the use of armed force, is one of those situations where the council has to weigh the objectives of the program against the negative consequences. Then we come to the area of UN peacekeeping and governance. And here, one of the most important aspects of U.S. action, UN action during the Cold War was the deployment of peacekeeping forces in places like Congo and the Middle East. But after the end of the Cold War, there was a great expansion, both in terms of the number and size of peacekeeping forces and also in the mandates that those forces were to carry out. Basically, after the end of the Cold War, there were four areas in which there was a tremendous expansion of peacekeeping activity. One was to facilitate the end of the various regional conflicts that had been part of the Cold War confrontation between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, places like Afghanistan, Namibia, Central America. Then there were a series of new conflicts which were essentially caused by the end of the Cold War, that is to say, the collapse of the Soviet Union and of the Yugoslav Republic, places like Bosnia, Croatia, the Caucasus. Then there were a series of internal conflicts, particularly in Africa, where the international community now desired to intervene with these new authorities, the new jurisdiction that the Council had. And finally, there were certain conflicts between states during this period where peacekeeping forces were needed, Iraq and Kuwait, Eritrea and Ethiopia. Altogether, this was a tremendous expansion in the size of the effort. For example, before 1987, there were only 15 UN peacekeeping missions that had been created during the entire period since the creation of the UN. But in the brief period between 88 and 94, there were over 20 additional peacekeeping forces created. And during that same period, the total of peacekeeping personnel in the world went from 12,000 up to 75,000. The total budget went from $250 million to over $3.5 billion. Very large quantum increase. But in addition, there was also an increase in the scope of the mandates that these peacekeeping missions were supposed to carry out. During the Cold War, most peacekeeping missions were so-called first-generation peacekeeping. That is to say, a situation in which a conflict had recently ended, military personnel were sent to monitor and deter resumption of conflict. But as the UN became involved in more internal conflict situations, it was obvious that it needed an expanded mandate for these forces, so-called second-generation peacekeeping, which involved not only this function of political, of military observance, but also assist in the reconstruction of societies with political and economic and humanitarian personnel. And then, with respect to East Timor and Kosovo, where you had essentially a total collapse of the governmental and economic structures of those territories, it became necessary for the UN to get into what's been called third-generation peacekeeping. That is to say, assume complete governance of the territories, at least for an interim period, which involved not only military activity, but also economic reconstruction, judges, prosecutors, police, all forms of governing personnel. Now, it's not the case that in the conflicts that followed this period that the UN always resorted to second or third generation peacekeeping mandates. I mean, you can look at Afghanistan and Iraq, where the functions of the UN missions were essentially very modest, to see that that was not the case. And obviously, there's no sense in saying that you should always have a second or a third generation peacekeeping force in this situation. However, I think the Iraq shows that there are serious dangers in over-reliance on unilateral action or over-reliance upon an occupying power or the governments created by it. And I think it is important that the international community not forget these second and third generation precedents and tools in deciding what kind of mandate to give a peacekeeping force. Next, the use of force. I think in some ways this is perhaps the most important development in the Council's practice in this period, because the Council authorized the use of force not only to defeat aggression, but also to deal with all of these other problems that it now recognizes threats to the peace, internal breakdown of societies, severe human rights violations, humanitarian catastrophes, overthrow of democratic regimes. All of these now were subject to Council authorization for the use of force to deal in some way with them. Sometimes the Council authorized its own peacekeeping forces to use force for these purposes, but very often it began to delegate the power to use force to non-UN entities, to states, to coalitions, to regional organizations. The most striking example of this, of course, was that following the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, where the Council authorized a coalition led by the United States to not only interdict maritime shipments to and from Iraq, but to take a broader action to restore international peace and security. In Yugoslavia, the Council authorized the use of force for specific purposes, maritime interdiction, enforcement of no-fly zones, the protection of civilians in safe zones, and so on. And then the Council authorized the use of force in various internal conflicts, for example, the U.S. in Somalia, France in Rwanda, U.S. in Haiti, Australia in East Timor. And all of this delegation to non-UN entities of the use of force raised a series of significant issues. First is the question of the degree to which the UN should retain control over such military operations. In the case of Desert Storm, the UN had no control. In the case of Bosnia, at least initially, there was the so-called dual key system in which there had to be approval by a UN authority prior to each important military operation, a system which ultimately had to be suspended to allow vigorous NATO military action against the Bosnian Serbs. Second question, how long does such an authorization to use force persist after the immediate conflict? This, of course, was an important issue in 2003 with respect to Iraq, where the U.S. and its coalition partners argued that they still had authorization dating back to 1991 from the Council, whereas others denied that this was the case. Third question, what happens when the use of force is obviously called for, but the Council is unable, because of its own internal political disagreements, to authorize it? A good example of this was Kosovo, where in the end NATO decided to proceed without Council sanction to deal with the very serious situation that occurred there. Next, during this period, the Council began to use its Chapter 7 authority to create new institutions and to give them important legal power. The best example of this, again, was with respect to Iraq after the Gulf War, where the Council created three important new institutions. The first was the UN Compensation Commission, which was charged with adjudicating and paying for the tremendous amount of damage which was caused to individuals and corporations and states by the Iraqi invasion and occupation of Kuwait. And here, the Council perceived that the traditional means of resolving such claims issues, which would typically would be case-by-case adjudication by arbitral panels, that this was going to be entirely too slow and entirely inadequate to deal with the tremendous volume and political importance and size of the claims that were resulting from the Gulf conflict. So the Council created a new institution which essentially acted as an administrative body rather than an adversary proceeding. And this new commission took some radically new kinds of steps, provided immediate relief to hundreds of thousands of individuals based on relatively little proof of their loss, then had expedited procedures to resolve the rest of the claims using modern mass claims techniques. And on the whole, this operation was extremely successful, resolving in a relatively short period of time over 2.5 million claims, for which more than $3.5 billion had been claimed, which had far exceeded any international claims process that had existed before. The second of the institutions created by the Council under its authority was the Iraq-Kuwait Boundary Commission to deal with the boundary dispute between Iraq and Kuwait that had been one of the ostensible causes for the war. And here again, the Council decided that existing arbitral mechanisms were not going to be adequate for the purpose, and so created a new commission, which was the majority of which was composed of independent experts, which rather quickly demarcated the boundary. The Council guaranteed the inviolability of the boundary and deployed a peacekeeping force to monitor it. And the third set of institutions that were created after the Gulf War were those to deal with the elimination of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and to conduct inspections thereafter to ensure that those capabilities were not reconstructed. This was UNSCOM and its successor, UNMOVIC. These institutions were charged with carrying out these functions with respect to chemical and biological weapons, and the Council delegated the same functions to the International Atomic Energy Agency with respect to nuclear capabilities. Now, as you know, following the creation of these institutions, there was a long period of struggle with Iraqi authorities who attempted to impede and obfuscate the process. And in the end, the United States decided to give up on the process and instead invaded Iraq in 2003. But as we also know, we have come more and more to realize in the years that followed that these UN teams were probably more successful than anybody had anticipated at the time in dealing with the WMD problem. Well, these three institutions were created and tailored by the Commission to deal with a specific Iraqi situation, but during the period the Council used many other techniques to deal with claims for damage from conflicts, to deal with other aspects of conflict situations, territorial disputes and arms control issues and so on. The point is that the Council used its Chapter 7 authority in a creative way to create institutions designed for specific problems, and it's important that we not forget all these precedents and forget the fact that the Council has this capability. Then prosecution of crimes. And I think one of the most important things that's happened in international law during this period is the revival of the prosecution of international crimes associated with conflict or terrorism situations, either by the international community or with the assistance of the international community. And I think that the Security Council was probably the most important driving factor in this process, all based upon a judgment by the Council that in specific situations it was useful to promote a restoration and maintenance of the peace to have a prosecution of such crimes, either for the purpose of ending or deterring the commission of crimes that might exacerbate a conflict, or to discourage reprisals by the victims of such crimes, or simply by removing the guilty parties from positions of political authority and international legitimacy. Of course, the only international prosecutions prior to the end of the Cold War were those after World War II in Nuremberg and Tokyo, notwithstanding the fact that during the Cold War there were many conflicts in which there were very serious atrocities committed. But the idea of international prosecution was revived by the Council in 1993 when it decided that it was necessary to have some kind of international prosecution for the atrocities being committed in Yugoslavia. The question was how to authorize such trials. Many proposed that a tribunal be created by the negotiation of a treaty, but there were serious problems with that approach. For one thing, it would have taken years to negotiate and bring into force such a treaty. For another, it would only have applied to those states which consented, which meant that they would never have applied to the states which were, in fact, the object of the effort in the former Yugoslavia. And in addition, it would have been difficult to use the mandatory powers of the Council to compel states to cooperate with the tribunal, which they had no obligation to do if they were not party to the treaty. So instead, the United States proposed that the tribunal be created by action of the Security Council under Chapter 7. And this had the immediate advantages of the immediate creation of the tribunals, at least on paper, plus the fact that all states were then immediately subject to the jurisdiction of the tribunals, including those who had not consented to the process, and the fact that the Council was now much more likely to use its Chapter 7 authority to back up the process. So this whole process was repeated the following year with respect to Rwanda. Now, the creation of these two tribunals led, I think, rather directly to the subsequent creation of the International Criminal Court. This was a permanent tribunal, which has the theoretical advantage that it now no longer needs to have some startup process for the creation of individual tribunals to deal with particular situations. This was not a creature of the Security Council, but the statute of the court gives the Security Council important functions within the system. In particular, the court only has jurisdiction over crimes that are committed within a state that has ratified or consented to the process or by nationals of such a state. And so there would theoretically be many situations in which the court would not have jurisdiction, but the Council is given the authority under the statute to refer such situations to the court. Furthermore, the Council can use its Chapter 7 authority to back up the court if it chooses to do so by using sanctions or other methods to require states to cooperate, for example, by turning over suspected individuals. And the Security Council has the unusual right under the statute to require the suspension of a prosecution or a trial whenever the Council finds that that's necessary. Now, you know that there has been a great debate within the United States as to whether the U.S. should adhere to the court, whether it should cooperate with the court. And, of course, the Bush administration had led a rather vigorous campaign to limit adherence to the court and to limit support for it. But it seems to me that both the U.S. on the one hand and the international court and its supporters on the other have an interest in a cooperative rather than an antagonistic relationship. The ICC, for its part, needs the support of the Council, and hence either the support or at least the acquiescence of the U.S. The U.S. will face situations in which it badly wants international prosecution, but there's no effective alternative to the international court doing so. And all of this was illustrated in the recent case of Sudan, where the court did not have jurisdiction because Sudan had not ratified the statute, but where the Council could authorize initiation of a case. And in the end, the United States accepted the fact that it was in its interest not to prevent that from happening. Hopefully, I think this shows the way in which there can be a more pragmatic and cooperative relationship between the U.S. and the court, particularly in cases where the defendants in a case do not include U.S. personnel. And then the Council acted in various other ways during this period to support prosecution for international crimes. Special Court for Sierra Leone was created under the Council's auspices. This is a so-called hybrid tribunal, which combines international and national personnel, international and national jurisdiction, international and national precedents. And in the case of Kosovo and East Timor, special courts were created for these purposes as part of the general administration of those territories under the Council's authority. And in the case of international terrorism, one of the things that the Council required all states to do was to prosecute persons who were engaged in international terrorist activities. And then in the case of the Pan Am 103 bombing, the Council applied sanctions to force Libya to surrender the individuals in question for trial by a British court. Okay, I'm running short. So let me ask the question, what is the overall significance of this great expansion of the exercise by the Council of Authority in these various different ways? Seems to me that all of this has provided an important new source of legal and political authority to solve international problems. The fact is, I think, that there is no other institution that offers the same possibilities for rapid action, for decisive action, for flexible and authoritative action. It's quite true, of course, that one can have decisive action unilaterally or by coalitions of the willing, but often this solution does not offer the kind of international legitimacy and legal validation that can be important parts of sustaining the overall mission. I think Chapter 7 has become a very flexible tool, making possible the creation of new institutions, new law, authoritative international decisions on issues that had heretofore been thought to be reserved to state sovereignty, the application of political and economic and military power by the international community to serve international objectives. At the same time, I think that these possibilities have now become an important tool for U.S. foreign policy purposes. That is to say, during the post-Cold War period, the expansion of the Council's exercise of authority became an important potential tool for U.S. initiatives, which might otherwise have been impossible to do or would have been much more difficult to do. Furthermore, since the Council's actions are subject to the veto, that means the Council cannot act contrary to U.S. interests, whereas unilateral action by the United States can be used as a precedent by others to take action at a later time contrary to U.S. interests. So it seems to me that when the U.S. considers possible options for dealing with a situation, that these various possibilities of Council action should be at the top of the agenda and not somewhere at the bottom because of some kind of preference for unilateral action. Now, it's obvious that all of this depends on a degree of consensus among the members of the Council, particularly among the permanent five. And obviously, in many cases, this was not present at times during the post-Cold War period. Kosovo, Iraq in 2003, more recently Sudan. And in such cases, the ability to use the Council's authority depends on the old traditional hard work of diplomacy, finding compromise, finding means of political pressure, finding creative solutions. But all of this, I think, is well worth the effort if the Council's potential authority and legitimacy can be used for good purposes. Now, it's obvious, and I'm sure that the other panel members will point this out, that the United Nations is not is often not a model of effectiveness and efficiency. It is vulnerable to maladministration, even corruption, to bureaucratic inertia, to undesirable political influences. And all this was demonstrated very vividly by the oil for food scandals. The UN, I think, is most successful when authorization is given to institutions that are professionally staffed, that have adequate resources and control systems, that have a certain insulation from political manipulation. And we know this can happen because we saw the effective operation of the technical commissions that I described with respect to Iraq and with the various peacekeeping and other missions maintained by the UN. But it takes a lot of hard work and reform of the UN system. So my bottom line is that it's still very much in the interest of the United States and the international community to be prepared to use this expanded authority of the Council in appropriate circumstances, to do so in a flexible way that's responsible and attuned to the particular requirements. And if the community is able to use this tool effectively, it can be a very important means of contributing to the solution of international problems. And now I'm going to quit, and I thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Mike. You pretty much have a perfect half an hour there. So now we'll turn to Ruth Wedgwood.
Well, I may be a little raggedy this morning because I'm coming back from 2.5 weeks in the UN basement from the Human Rights Committee, which, as with much UN work, as I'm sure Mike knows, you're sitting there doing not very much, but it knocks the stuffing out of you. Like waiting in a train station for something to happen, and all of a sudden a screeching emergency. But I first want to do my roast part on Michael's book. I take this to be actually the nice companion volume to my favorite college text, which was David Landy's Prometheus Unbound, which was a discussion of the rise of technology in Western civilization and how it drove economic growth. And it's also a kind of enigmatic title. It's not clear if you're supposed to read it up and then horizontal or quite this way. UN Council bound or is it Council unbound? Anyway, whichever. Now, for those of you who don't know Michael, he really has been the kind of sage presence in L for many, many years. I would call him a gentle realist. He's not naive about how multilateral politics works. L, Legal Advisor's Office in the State Department, always gets the catch when the USUN is pitching about how a resolution should be worded or those small little tweaks that might make a deal go through. So, in fact, much of the state practice that informs what you think of as the kind of customary law extension of Security Council authority has been crafted by Michael, and therefore this is like Justinian writing his own code. He's in the perfect position to capture the state practice that is extremely important. You can't just read this little blue book and know what is permitted, not permitted. There's a kind of a sonorousness that the orchestra is supposed to have that you only know if you live in the Vienna Philharmonic for a while, but not if you just walk in as a novitiate. And it's very important, frankly. This is one of your better grants, because it's very important that this be captured before it disappears with the retirement of people who were there at the creation, because there very much is a customary law overlay, I think, that informs what is otherwise seen as purely a treaty instrument. And the sense of what's been done before, therefore what precedent you have to cite, is extraordinarily important. I'm shoplifting a copy to give to Marin Strumecki to give to Zal, because if he's wondering whether he can do something in the council, this kind of capture of state practice is so hugely important. And I think also in a way that Michael has been too modest, the council is supposed to be kind of like Federalist 87, it's supposed to be the celebration of the UN's executive power. It's supposed to be the hammer of the UN that actually makes things happen when it's an emergency. It's supposed to be the source of prerogative power when the law is not quite adequate, when the treaty frameworks aren't adequate. It's always been very ambiguous whether the council can act, I won't say illegally, but extra-legally or becomingly legally, with this long-standing debate about whether they have the right to go beyond what is established customary law and treaty frameworks to do things that are adapted to an emergency. And in that sense, some of the, I think, the moral mortification of the present time at times attaches to the council as well. But it really is Hamilton's idea of the executive, vigorous, I won't say stealthy, but still there for the emergency. But for all those reasons, it's at the center of controversy. People want to know when should it act, what can it do, what can't it do, what happened to all the other organs of the UN that other countries think that they have a voice in, that have competitive authority, and why is it the council doesn't operate the way it was supposed to. As we all remember, in 45, the council was supposed to have a standing army, a standing or flying air force, and be able really to have its own joystick to undertake effective security operations around the globe. Never happened because of the Cold War. And there is actually not even now taken to be a right to demand the donation of troops, although I think one could read Article 43 and 45 of the Charter as creating at least a soft law obligation on the part of countries to donate troops. But really, what the Council's remitted to doing is voting authorization for things, authorizing COWs, coalitions of the willing, to do action in the name of the UN, but with their own voluntary choice whether to take part or not. And that gives you a very incomplete framework for collective security. Now, in Michael's book, there's lots of controversial matters that he addresses, and he treats them very quietly. You'll have to read this book with ears to hear if you're really to see what's... He does. He doesn't put in boldface type the parts that are sassy. So I'll just point out some of them, if I may. One question that's always come up is, can the Security Council limit the right of self-defense? Ask any Bosnian Muslim. Circa 1992, chafing at the bit as the Council has enacted and enforced with Operation Sharp Guard an arms embargo on the former Yugoslavia, which means Belgrade had lots of weapons and Bosnia had relatively few. And the Bosnians say this is a violation of our Article 51 right of self-defense. You can't make us into plucked chickens. This is clearly ultra virus. Can that be done or not? Now, Michael, in this case, I might disagree, but he says, page 132, exercise of the right of self-defense is clearly subject to the authority of the Council under Chapter 7, and the Council may choose to exercise its authority in a particular case. So a very controversial issue. Can you actually cut away a country's right of self-defense if, in fact, there's a good faith basis to believe that the Council is not fully protecting that country? Issue two, does Council discussion of a matter preclude further exercise of the right of self-defense if they take up the issue of Sudan but don't do anything effective? Does that preclude other countries from collectively choosing to engage in self-help? Or in the case of Bosnia, the fact that the Council was discussing it, would that have precluded Bosnia from summoning a right of collective self-help? My Sudan example is misplaced because it's an endangered minority, not a country. And Michael says, I think correctly, that the right answer is no, that the mere fact that the Council is chatting about something, the mere fact that the Council issues resolutions that say in their last paragraph, we remained seized of the matter, is not sufficient to preclude the right of self-help, because the Council chats ad nauseum oftentimes and is seized and seizing for a long time, and therefore you ought not to have mere discussion preclude the right of self-help. Third one, can self-defense reach non-state actors? Clearly very interesting in the wake of 9/11, clearly very interesting in the Israeli wall case, and Michael takes on the court headlong and says the Council got it right and the court got it wrong, if they meant what they said. That's a lawyer's politeness for saying they got it wrong, but we're not going to give them a chance to back down. After 9/11, in 1368, the Council says there is a right of self-defense in light of the September 11th attacks, even though the actors were non-state actors. In the Israeli wall case, the court said there was no Article 51 right of self-defense because the actors were non-state actors who came within the country's own territory. And I think Michael's quite courageous in saying that that is horse feathers. Fourth issue, can humanitarian threats ever be a threat to the peace in and of themselves? And we tend not to challenge that one because we like the result, but I do think if you've taken a strict constructionist, a Scalian classicist circa 1945, they might have doubted whether sheer human suffering was sufficient to intervene circa 1945, when states were quite jealous of their prerogative. Michael dodges it a little bit. He says on page 139, with a kind of a factual flip, virtually any massive campaign of atrocities is likely to have repercussions on other states that would justify a finding of a threat to the peace by the council. I like the results. I see through the legal fiction. Yes, there'll be refugee flows. Yes, there'll be destabilization of a region. But in truth and in fact, what's pushing this debate is the belief that one's conception of human peace, of international peace, has to be somewhat broader than simply no interstate war. It's got to be a richer, succulent version of what it means to be protected. And frankly, in 1992, at the head of state summit, when the council was first reasserting its authority, it was the South that embraced that kind of idea of a rich peace, where they said that environmental problems or economic problems or disease could also be threats to the peace. Controversial issue number five, can the Security Council give away operational control on an authorized mission? Because many countries don't like the fact that the U.S. or its close friends may remain in the operator on a authorized intervention. And Michael says with great realism, no choice but to do that. There's no joystick on the 38th floor. The Situation Room doesn't have 24/7 intelligence access. You really can't hope to have deconflicting of friendly fire unless you have an operator on the ground who has experience in military operations. And the UN itself in the mid-90s conceded that it really could not ever suppose itself to be the ground control. Sixth controversial topic, can the council action ever be reviewed? Is the council the end of the debate? And we all saw with great chagrin and fear in the Lockerbie case, which had to do with the attempted extradition of the two Lockerbie bombing suspects from Libya, where the U.S. and the Brits raised it in a Chapter 7 resolution in the Council, spoke of it in veiled terms because it was so unprecedented for the Council to demand the extradition of two suspects. Never been done before. And under customary law, problematic, because customary law has said that there's no duty to extradite in the absence of a treaty framework. But when the Lockerbie case was then brought by Libya in the ICJ challenging the attempt to try the Lockerbie suspects, at least three judges on the court intimated that someday, somewhere, somehow, they might themselves pronounce a theory of judicial review. They did it coyly. They said, we aren't reviewing the council directly. We just know that they wouldn't ever want to act illegally, and we'll help inform them as to what would be illegal or not. And goodness gracious, I'm not sure the State Department reacted with entirely the alarm that I did. But eventually, this was put to rest, and it didn't come to Armageddon. But Michael says with great, I think, appropriate drama, that if the ICJ ever were to foursquarely assert the authority to review council action, that it would practically be the death of the council. That it would mean that people would run to the ICJ seeking advisory opinions, that there'd be the sense that the ICJ ought to wait for the court to make up its mind. The council ought to wait for the ICJ to make up its mind, and the sense of being able to step into the situation in a timely way would be lost. But you see the same thing coming on board now with the ICC, actually. If the ICC should take up the question of aggression, then the council would lose its current monopoly on pronouncing what is an act of aggression. So I do think once you start down this road of having other organs competitively gainsay the council's decisions, you are going to end up cutting the Achilles tendon of the council. Other interesting topic, can the council ever give legitimacy to an operation other than by a four-square authorization? Does it have to pass a Chapter 7 resolution? And Michael very appropriately looks at the many kinds of ways, the chiaroscura of how the council acts, often through presidential statements of uncertain legal import, but it means a country doesn't have to vote in favor of it. It can just acquiesce. And I have now learned myself the hard way the meaning of UN consensus. It means you may not be very happy, but you're not going to kick and fuss and keep business from proceeding. It gives you a certain deniability as to whether you really embraced it, but it lets the work go on. And it's a kind of majoritarian rule that has to finally carry the day, and implied action as well by the Council. In ECOWAS, Council, in the intervention in Sierra Leone and Liberia, the Council never bothered to authorize it. It just said, good job, guys, after the fact, and thereby rewrote the meaning of Chapter 8 of the Charter and the meaning of the role of regional organizations. Eighth controversial issue, can the Security Council delegate its functions, and if so, how much? And there is, I think, controversy over this. Some people doubted that the Council really was competent to create a court. Some people have worried that the sanctions committees have too much power and have due process problems. If a financial institution gets on the list, how does it get off the list? And is it a misuse or at least an unwise use of the Council's legitimacy to be setting up machinery whose bona fides it later can't supervise closely? Ninth, I'm getting to the end, framework resolutions. Should you ever use Council authority as a substitute for treaties? We see in the Council's resolutions about terrorist financing that they've taken on board the entire text, almost one can say, of the Terrorist Financing Convention. So you don't have to wait for states to sign up, but rather can just now impose it upon them as a Chapter 7 obligation. And 10th, what happens when the Council does act? Does it de facto make law? And here I think perhaps the lesson for us occasional unilateralists, the lesson has not been entirely taken. But I think it's fair to say that when the Council itself diagnoses a problem and acts in a particular way, one reasonably infers that the Council viewed that kind of action as legitimate. In process versus product. You may not like doing it in a non-multilateral setting. You might far prefer multilateral decision-making. But the very fact that the Council has felt the need to intervene in a kind of situation may give a quiet, reasoning by analogy precedent for countries when they feel the need to act without Council authorization, either in self-styled coalitions of the willing or even unilaterally. And the most telling moment was in the high-level panel report December 2004, in which the Council itself said, if you had irresponsible states with weapons of mass destruction, that could constitute a threat to the peace, in which the Council would have to act. And then in probably an unhappy tautology, they said, if it's really urgent, the Council will act. If they don't act, it must not be urgent. Fair enough, as far as it goes. And finally, let me just say that I do think that the Council is undoubtedly going to remain the subject of controversy. All the questions about Security Council reform, should you expand it, should you put, even though it would slow down the deliberations, should you put Japan and Germany on it, even though they could predictably have far more hostile attitudes toward intervention than we would like to see, go to the fact that the Council has taken on board much more wide-ranging authority than we've seen heretofore. And I do think that ultimately, if you try to load too much onto the Council, it's going to backfire, that we do have to pay attention to General Assembly reform. I have been riding my little hobby horse of wondering why the General Assembly is basically organized now as a set of regional and ideological collectivities instead of being a Jürgen Habermas situation of perfect discourse and speech, why the issue is often decided before you get out of the closed meeting of the G-132, also known as the G-77, that you really ought to think through how you make General Assembly action more productive. And my one strange, tiny little step to that end would, strange to say, be to allow secret ballots, not open ballots, secret ballots in the General Assembly, so that countries could stray from their blocks without being punished for it in all the immediate issues that are important to their local economy or local situation. But I do think that thinking of the UN as simply a collection of regional positions is not what the founders had in mind. And yet practice, the same kind of practice that's collected in this book, has instantiated it so deeply into the organization that we have often had to give up on the General Assembly. And you see that in the outcome of the Human Rights Council, where, again, the outcome was determined before you began. And I will just finally say that there's no substitute for good diplomacy. I hope that Nizal is a big back-slapping, bear-hug kind of guy. So it takes a kind of romantic realist to make this organization work, but one ought not to be naive about the halters of multilateralism and not to become a process perfectionist where it's the process and not the product that counts. Jim Traub's book on Kofi is a beautiful, beautiful biography of the last 15 years, if you will. And Traub, who's a pal of mine, but he has a tendency to become a little bit temporarily infatuated with some of the people he describes, but because they're charismatic. But ultimately, I think even he takes the view that there's a kind of desultory, tropique quality if you allow process to be your only objective, and that lawyers who are good lawyers know that you need process and results to really maintain the legitimacy of any kind of legal framework. And John Rawls himself said it, perfect versus procedural justice. You judge one by the other, and if one is out of kilter, so is the other. So I think Michael's book is actually very important in giving courage, like the old Australian beer, take courage, when you stray a little bit off the fracture type of the charter, the plain text of the charter, because the charter has really changed fundamentally in the last 60 years and will continue to change.
Thank you, Ruth. Now we'll hear from Jacques.
Good morning. First of all, I must say I very much admire the book. I mean, it's a solid piece of work, which I think will help as we work through the process. But even as we speak, Darfur still goes on. Thousands of people are being killed, and very little is being done about it. And that is the reality of, number one, that's the Darfurs and the other things that go on around us. I've now led three UN peacekeeping missions, one in Croatia, one in Bosnia, and the last in Liberia. As you know, right now, in the U.S. public, I think only about 64% of Americans think the UN is doing a good job. It could be doing a much better job, but for all the reasons we've heard, it's not. I want to take us, in a sense, from the macro level to the micro level. What really happens here in the dynamic? I've led a Chapter 5 mission, a Chapter 6 mission, a Chapter 7 mission. The reality is, as we all know, you have these 192 countries in the General Assembly who have plenipotentiary power to declare war and peace and realize they can't. They're too large, it's too unwieldy, too many differences, too much regionalism. So we defer. We give this authority to the Security Council, the five perm reps and the 10 rotators. Now, the reality of what happens in a crisis is very simple. Let us just imagine for a moment that there's a fire burning in some part of the world, and we can't put it out, unilaterally, bilaterally, trilaterally, and someone says, this is an issue for the Security Council and the UN. And it comes to the Security Council. And they immediately take note that there is a fire burning, something probably needs to be done. And the first thing he does is ask his assistant, do we have any property insured in that part of town? And the answer is probably no, so I don't really give a damn. She says, look, that region, that area, they helped us in X, Y, and Z. Something does need to be done. We should make some commitment here. Can't we do something? Someone else suggests, yes, it's a fire. It's not that great of a fire, that large of a fire. Can we say that we have two water pumper trucks that we're willing to provide, one ladder truck, 250 firemen? Then immediately the debate begins. Who's going to be the fire chief? Which one of these countries will actually name the fire chief? But the argument goes on, and after about two or three days of endless discourse and debate, there is an agreement that two pumper trucks, one ladder truck, and 250 firemen are authorized by mandate to the Secretary General to go out and put out this fire. Now, the Secretary General's problem is, where do I get the fire trucks? And where do I get the firemen? You get on the Rolodex, because that is the reality. Peru is willing to give you a fire truck. They have a 1937 Mack pumper that they're not using anymore because Würzburg, Germany is getting new ones, and they're giving Peru their old ones. The Danes are very helpful. They give you a pumper. And the Canadians give you the ladder truck. The 250 firemen will probably be 25 firemen from various countries, and then we have to argue about the fire chief. We also realize that these firemen's languages are not necessarily interoperable. So now we have our two fire trucks. The problem is the Mack 1937 truck is a gasoline-driven truck. The diesel we have from Denmark is diesel. The hoses are a different size. They're not interoperable. The ladder truck actually only goes to the fourth floor. But what do we do with people who go on the sixth and seventh? And then we fight about the fire chief. Now, that is the reality of how it works. Now, let me give you the practical. In the case of a place like Liberia, in 2003, Liberia was in chaos, obviously. You had a city of 1,400,000. Not starvation, but malnutrition, paranoia, claustrophobia, no news of the world, a city without running water, without electricity, without a sewage system. And the Secretary General said, something needs to be done. And obviously he had spoken to Kufuor, Kaba, and Mbeki and the rest of them, and they agreed that some action should be taken. So naturally, the UN said, we will take this on, but we must ask the Americans what they think and what they're willing to do. So he held a meeting with the President in the presence of the Secretary of State, the Vice President, who else was there? Andrew Card, Chief of Staff, etc. And the Americans immediately said, Liberia really isn't our problem. In fact, it is. Liberia is America's stepchild, always has been. It's not our problem. We can't really put anyone on the ground because we're too busy elsewhere. But colon can't echo, what is it called here, ECOWAS, ECOMEL, can't one of those people do something? Yes, that we can pay for it. So then we put an African force on the ground, 150 people from various countries, no interoperable equipment, no common language, no real command and control, and while we, quote, stood up the UN mission. The council was briefed on the 9th of September. On the 13th of September, they passed the mandate, and now we have the mandate. 15,000 troops, 1,400 policemen, 400 or 500 civilians. Where are they? They're nowhere around. Now you get on the Rolodex. If you want infantry, you go to Bangladesh, Pakistan, India. You want a division? We'll give you a division. 10,000, 5,000, 3,000. Why? It's $1,200 a month. It's a reasonable salary. The money doesn't go to the troops, by the way. The money goes to the national government. All right, so we have our brigades now. We have Bangladeshis, Pakistanis, Nigerians. That's easy. Where's my communicator? Where's my hospital? Where's my engineering battalion? Now, you find Europeans don't like to wear short pants, so you won't find any of them around. We managed to get one company of Swedes by personally calling the State Secretary in Sweden, Hans Dahlgren, and saying, Hans, you're the representative to the African Union, etc. Can't you do something? Yes. And then the Irish gave us a company because they've been with us for peacekeeping since the very beginning. No one else showed up. Other countries came down, specifically Morocco, don't like the climate. I mean, you realize there's malaria here, dengue fever, Lassa fever. Jordan came in. Really can't help you with what you want. So you're fishing. So we have Namibia finally coming in, etc. And then convoluted things happen, because this is the real world, not the theoretical world. The Chinese ambassador said, you know, we did good work together in the Balkans. We actually had Chinese policemen in the Balkans, because we had women being trafficked from Beijing to Belgrade. And so we had 15 Chinese policemen, four of them women on the staff. I can help you, but we have a problem. You see, Liberia recognizes Taiwan. Taiwan pays the next $1 million a year for recognition. If you can fix that, we may be able to do something. So we then clandestinely flew the Chinese delegation from Sierra Leone to Monrovia, negotiated all day, and at 15 minutes to midnight, Liberia actually recognized the People's Republic of China as the China. And as I told the President, Moses Bly, I said, look, there's only politically one China. No one says you can't trade with Taiwan. It's not the issue. Political recognition of reality. He said, if I do that, they'll kill me. You know, you realize how much money they're paying us. I said, if they don't kill you, I'll kill you. He said, yeah, but you're just joking. They're serious. No. In any case, we did it. And then the Chinese said, all right, what do you need? I said, I need an engineering battalion, and I need a hospital. And we got both of those. The president, by the way, Moses Block, called me a week later and said, you know, you were right. We did the right thing. I said, why? He said, well, Muammar Gaddafi called me and said, you were right in recognizing the People's Republic. You know why? Libya and China have had a 40-year-plus relationship. Most of the infrastructure in Libya is, you know, cement, concrete, highways, Chinese-built. Now, that's the reality. Now, the mission, quote, was initiated on 1 October 2003. By April 2004, we were still only 60% manned in terms of what we really needed, human rights officers, political officers, and on the military side, all the engineering and what have you. That's the reality of a mission. And that's what most people really don't quite fundamentally understand. It isn't simply mandates. Now, Security Council also gives a strong mandate. You may say seize Charles Taylor's property, the property of his associates, you can prevent travel, you can do X, Y, and Z. It's all there. So I actually put together a group and a force and said, let's do this. And went to New York and said, I intend to initiate action to do A, B, C, and D. And they said, no, 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 no. That mandate didn't give you the authority to do it. It merely suggested a possible course of action which might be taken if it might be approved at some point in time. So then my question to the council was, why did you put the mandate there then? Makes us feel good. Makes us feel good. Now that's the UN side of the equation. The other side of the equation, which we really haven't discussed, is the whole panoply of UN agencies over whom the Secretary General has no control at all. He can basically negotiate when it comes time to select a new representative for UNHCR, UNICEF, or anything else. But in terms of practical day-to-day management, he has no authority. It's a different budget. It's totally a different stovepipe operation. And when you're in a situation where the Secretary General says to you, I want you to establish an integrated mission with every UN agency on board, and then you present such a proposal to this UN agency heads, their attitude is simply, we have no orders from New York. No one has given us any such mandate, and therefore we will continue to operate as we have. So the unanimity in the UN family is not there. That's also an area of major, major concern, which desperately needs to be dealt with if we're going to have any kind of unity of action. Now that I go back to Darfur, that's what we started with. Why is nothing being done? We're all talking about UN action, something, people dying, media, newspaper, full-page ads. Nothing is being done. Why? Well, there's certain large Chinese oil concessions in Darfur. I'm not in Darfur, in Sudan. I'm sure Bashir is worried about some possible indictment for war crimes, you know. Why wasn't anything done in Rwanda? Romeo Dallaire said, with 5,000 troops, 5,000, I can control this. I know where the arms are hidden. I have the documentation. I know what they're planning to do on the radio. I can shut this down. And not only did they give them the 5,000, they cut them back. And 800,000 people were killed. And all the people who were involved with that particular issue at that point in time all say, if I'd known a little more, if I'd studied the issue better, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And as I'm afraid, the sequence that we continue following, Darfur is the perfect example. We cannot decide, are we going to have a Chad mission? Is it a Darfur-Sudan mission? Or is it the old Sudan North-South prompt mission? So they dither. And what does that mean? It means that, as I wrote when I left, I said, my own experience in Croatia, Bosnia, and Herzegovina, and Liberia have convinced me that more than words or goodwill are needed, more than documentation or charters. All too often, the United Nations and the many non-governmental organizations and their human rights counterpart in UN parlance argue for compliance, urge parties to honor their commitments, or demand immediate action without taking any themselves. All too often the focus is on polite rhetoric and some passive engagement resulting in nothing being done. And if you ever look at UN resolutions, I mean, how do they start off? We take note of the problem. We're actively seized by the issue. We express the gravest concern. We urge the parties to honor their commitments. We regret the delay in complying with the agreement. We demand the immediate cessation of. We will stay actively engaged. But when are you going to do something? And that's the problem I have. Now, as far as reform goes, I tend to agree with my colleague who said, you know, what do you do with reform? If you actually look at the countries that are lobbying for membership on the Security Council, five of the leading candidates voted against the U.S. 70% of the time. So what are you doing? In terms of the institution itself, there is no structure to it, in a sense. In other words, Americans always get confused, the UN, the UN. There is no UN, there is a Security Council. And then Kofi Annan is kind of the chief executive officer over a very flawed structure. And UN reform is time and again killed. We saw that last fall again. Because the developing world doesn't want reform. What you want is nepotism, cronyism, etc. I said to Kofi once, you know, I call him Chef. I said, Chef, listen, three missions now. Nepotism, cronyism, corruption. It's a medieval system. It's dysfunctional. It doesn't work. He said, Jack, I know that. I used to be the director of personnel. Now, what does that mean? It means that the Secretary General, by the way, that shouldn't rotate necessarily. Nothing says SecGens rotate. That's just grown up kind of a historical phenomenon. So if you looked at this time around, what did you have here? By definition, you could say India neutralizes Pakistan. Japanese, for historical reasons, probably not really that acceptable. Australians or Caucasians don't count. No one likes Burmese generals. That leaves you Thailand, Singapore, Malaysia, Korea. And that's where you have to come from. Now, you come from there with compromises, because it's just like any other organization. What do you need to get what do I need to get your vote? You know. Now, there is no foreign service here. Foreign service is a very system with a great deal of merit and a tradition in it. You take an exam and you're a number. You're not even a name. You're not a name till you actually have the oral panel. So there's an upward mobility and structure to this. In the UN, none of that exists. In fact, in all my missions, when I think about it, only 10%, 15% were permanent career UN employees. The rest are on 6-month or 1-year contracts, which creates a tremendous amount of unevenness, because if I say to you, look, I think February 2003, we can close the mission in Bosnia-Herzegovina, the mission has been accomplished, and you hear that, by August, September of the preceding year, you're already bailing out, looking for Georgia, East Timor, Kashmir, Cyprus, or something else. Because you're living on a 1-year contract, basically, which is what most of these people are in peacekeeping. Fundamental, flawed structure, which just doesn't work. So there's no professional military cadre to draw on. And remember, we had a group of people in the building who were professionals from largely, let's say, UK, Australia, Canada, etc. But a few years ago at some point, one of the delegates from South America said, look, these people are freebies provided by these countries, which gives them an inordinate influence. Any position that's required should be justified, documented, and funded. Therefore, creating more jobs for us, obviously. When those several hundreds of people left, much of the operational side of the building collapsed, the administrative, the communicators, those people who know how to do logistics, how to get 5,000 people into Eastern Slavonia in 6 weeks, those kinds of things. So the building has that lack. So the promotion system is there, but it's ad hoc. The performance evaluation system is ad hoc. And indeed, in my missions, I've had at any number of places, two or three ambassador, the occasional foreign minister, or the prime minister in the mission. Now, why? He's the ambassador from whatever to the UN. There's a coup in his country. The president, his brother-in-law, is out. He's out. And someone said, look, but he's been a decent guy here in the building. Can't we find him a little P5, P6, D1, something out there? Because literally I had the situation where I looked out my window in Sarajevo and saw a man sitting in the backseat of a car for about 20 minutes. And I sent my deputy out to find out what the problem was. And he was waiting for his driver. I said, no, here you're a P4, human rights officer. There is no driver. You're now a working person. But still, 80, 90,000 as a P4 is a lot better than $3,200 in country X, where he would have gone back to at some risk to his life. So I would think if you're talking about UN reform, you need to start a professional personnel system, a real understanding of how a chief executive officer manages a building. Because no one quite understands. You're sitting on top of this pile here with your deputy now. We have a Burmese Secretary General and a woman from Tanzania as a deputy. They aren't just managing that building. they have 192 delegations impacting on them, on everything from major substantive issues to my nephew's graduating from Harvard this summer, isn't there something for him in the building? That's in New York. Now, there are not 192 in New York. Most of them are represented. But then you've got all day long the phone calls coming in. But you have no idea. That switchboard is unbelievable. And again, it's prime minister, it's president, it's head of parliament, it's we're coming to New York, a delegation, whatever committees and other functions that exist that just impact and inundate and suffocate you to the point where you can't cut through to the basics. So you have a chief executive officer, in a sense, being micromanaged by about 192 people, all of whom demand, you know, and you ought to hear the debates. You know, my prime minister is coming, and he wants to see you. All right, we can block 20 minutes? Have you spelled my country's name recently? We are a 40-minute country, and I will not tolerate anything less, and I'm not joking about that. And he got 40 minutes instead of 20. 20 is for the... So major reform is needed. I don't know how we're going to do it, though, because, as I said, the developing countries see this in many ways as a benefit. Every UN employee's children a $10,000 education allowance a year, which is more than any of us have ever gotten in any foreign service or anywhere else. So if I'm six children and I'm a diplomat from a small country somewhere, there's a real advantage to the UN for me. What I found often lacking was a dedication to the institution. I happen to believe in the institution. I believe that the United Nations is a useful and helpful instrument and is a place for, as a conduit for dialogue for many, many things. And in many areas, which we haven't discussed, really does very, very good work. But many people don't see it that way. They see it as a trough to feed on. And again, I don't know how to change that, because the people who would have to reform, who would have to change, are the very ones who are profiting now and don't necessarily want to do it. So the mechanism of the council, as I said, is hit or miss, and I've seen it all. It really depends how strong your ambassador is, how articulate he is, how carefully crafted that mandate is, how well he works with what amount to the corridors. Because you don't want to walk into the council and have the Chinese veto something on Sudan. You want to work this thing intelligently and say, look, no one is interested in your oil concessions. That will not be an issue. It won't be touched. We're interested in humanitarian assistance for Darfur. All we want is a safe, secure environment to do the work that we do so well. So I believe in the UN. I also believe it dramatically needs reform. I would hope that they use these new authorities, and they're building them. You can see that, and Michael's documented this very nicely. We've built a whole series of new authorities which the United Nations could exercise constructively if it really had the structure and the will and the administrative wherewithal to really carry on through. So let me stop there, and we'll take some questions.
Great. Thank you, Jacques. Thank you all to the panelists. I think we should start out by giving Mike in particular a chance to respond. And given that we have only about a half hour left, I'd like to, after that, open up to the audience for questions. I have a few of my own that I'll ask, time permitting. And for those of you in the audience who would like to ask a question or make a comment, we ask that you line up on either side of the room behind the microphones. Okay, so I'll turn the floor over to Mike.
Feel free to stay seated.
Yeah, okay. Can you hear me from this? Yeah, right. Well, I thought the two presentations by the panelists were just excellent and brought out issues that I had not been able to handle. I just wanted to comment on a couple of aspects. First of all, Ruth gave you a very interesting little synopsis of legal issues kind of hidden away in my book and trying to compare how she would react to how I would react. And I think on most points we seem to be more or less in agreement. Let me comment on a couple of them. First of all, this question of whether the Council can act by implied action rather than by expressly adopting a formal resolution. And as she suggested, I indicated there were some circumstances in which I thought that would be acceptable. But I do have one area in which I think it's a problem, because it's often been asserted when the United States or somebody else could not get the Council to adopt a resolution that nonetheless, we should assume that the Council impliedly accepted it because it was only because some permanent member was going to veto it that it didn't occur. And I think in that particular situation, it's probably a danger to take that attitude. Certainly, the permanent members have a right under the charter to exercise their vetoes, and it's in the interest of the U.S. and others to be able to do so. And I think it sort of turns the structure on its head to say when somebody's prepared to veto, nonetheless, we'll assume the council impliedly accepted it. With respect to the question of whether council action can substitute for treaties, I think in many ways it can. The council can create legal obligations equivalent to that which might be created by a treaty. In fact, can go beyond that which created by a treaty. For example, the creation of the ad hoc criminal tribunals, the creation of the UN Compensation Commission were actions taken under council authority that might traditionally have been done by treaty. But we have to have a bit of caution here, because it's often argued that the council engages in acting as if it were a global legislature, and clearly there are limits to which the international community will be prepared to tolerate general law making by the council, so that the council, I think, has the theoretical authority to do this, but has to be careful in its exercise to not strain the limits of what is generally acceptable to the community. Ruth did not raise one issue, which I touch on in the book, which in some ways is the ultimate question about the council's authority. But although it may sound theoretical, we now have a practical case of it, and that is Kosovo. And the question is, can the council take action which will legally change the status of some territory, grant it independence, give it autonomy, give it some kind of self-determination, change its boundaries? And in the book, I argue that I think there are situations in which the council does have that authority under Chapter 7. Kosovo may be an example of that, but that it has to be extremely careful in exercising such far-reaching authority, again, because it can easily go beyond what is politically tolerable in the community. Jacques' presentation I enjoyed very much, and he, of course, points out a very important fact that there is a definite gap between, on the one hand, the theoretical authorization and theoretical legal authority, and on the other hand, the practical implementation of that authority on the ground in real-world situations. Obviously, there is a big need in such cases for both sensible political action and taking on responsibility, providing resources, acting sensibly, acting smart, particularly when diplomats need to act smart when they try and put these actions together. That's all very important and very important to keep in mind. He points out some of the deficiencies of the standing UN system, the inadequacies of the personnel system, the presence of corruption and nepotism. All of this is very true, and all of this obviously demands drastic action in the case of reform of the standing system. But I want to point out that in many of the cases I was describing, what in effect happened was that we went outside the standing system to create bodies which operated somewhat independently of the regular UN structure. For example, the creation of the UN Compensation Commission was essentially outside the Secretariat's operation, had its own source of funding and its own personnel system. The same is true with respect to the International Criminal Tribunals, which of necessity had to be created somewhat outside the purview of the Secretariat itself. So you always have a question in initiating a new exercise whether to try and subsist with the resources and structure of the Secretariat, or to try and create some kind of new structure that might hopefully give you a little bit of an advantage. He described the practical problems of producing real results on the ground, and he did it in the very vivid context of Africa and Eastern Europe. We lawyers did it something similar, but in the somewhat more rarefied context of creating legal institutions. But many of the problems were the same. You have to have practical solutions, not theoretical solutions. For example, when we decided we needed to have international criminal prosecutions, there were, you know, 1,000 problems to solve. Where were we going to put such a tribunal? Where could we find a government who would actually host such an operation? Well, let's go to the Dutch. They like international tribunals. They think The Hague is the greatest thing in the world. And that worked. They found us a building, but we had to find money for all of this. It took the Secretariat a couple of years before they put substantial resources into this, so we had to go by hook and crook. Where do we get the personnel? Where do we find prosecutors? Where do we find investigators who can conduct a decent criminal case? Well, that was pretty hard in the first few years, so what did we do? We went to the Justice Department. We went to the Department of Defense. Please, we said, secund some of your prosecutors and trial attorneys. to the UN process for a couple of years. What they said? What are you talking about? So, you know, it takes this kind of practical effort, and we had the same kind of problems in putting together a machinery for the Compensation Commission to adjudicate 2.5 million claims. Secretary couldn't do that, so we had to find independent funding sources, an independent means of putting the thing together. So we all have these practical problems, and they are at the heart of making such a system work. But underlying all this is the fact that none of this is possible if there is not legal authority which gives political legitimacy to these exercises in the first place. And without this expansion in the Council's assertion of legal authority during the post-Cold War period, there would be no Jacques Klein, there would be no Mike Matheson, there would be none of these exercises. So it takes a combination of a legal foundation and a lot of practical effort.
Great. Thank you. Well, while the audience waits to come up with some questions, I'll throw out a few questions to the panel. Okay, you ready to?
Sure.
Okay, I thought there wasn't any interest so far from the, but please go ahead. And if you could introduce yourself and state your name and affiliation.
My name's Cliff Kincaid. I write for Accuracy in Media and cover international affairs. It was going to be a two-part question. The second was just alluded to. Now, I'm not a lawyer, but I wish someone could explain to me in common sense, reasonable and understandable terms how in the case of Kosovo, the United Nations Security Council can assume the power to dismember a sovereign state. And if that's possible, then doesn't that mean, were it not for the U.S. seat on the Security Council, that Security Council could take up the issue, for example, of whether the United States illegally seized Hawaii, and whether Puerto Rico ought to be free and independent. My second question gets back to the creation of these criminal tribunals. I read the UN Charter as a layman, and I see that they form this International Court of Justice, which can issue rulings and opinions, but really has no power or authority. And yet I see the UN Security Council creating international tribunals with the power to arrest people, to literally pick them up off the streets, put them in prisons. Where does this power come from? It's not in the UN Charter. Where does it come from? And if they can simply make up these powers on their own, what's really stopping them other than the membership of the five, the big five? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, Mike, if you want to start us off.
Sure. Great. Important questions. Mm-hmm. You have to realize that in adhering to the UN Charter, states, in fact, gave up a tremendous amount of sovereignty. They agreed that if the Security Council acted under Chapter 7, found a threat to the peace, that it could use the measures specified in Articles 41 and 42. And these measures specified in those articles are an open-ended list. Article 41 says you can take measures necessary to deal with the situation, including blah, 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 but not limited to. And so there's a very open-ended character of that grant of authority in Chapter 7. Now, as a practical matter, that could have scary implications like the ones you described. Kosovo presents this in very vivid form. We have a part of the territory of Yugoslavia that had always been recognized by other states as part of Serbia now. Can the Security Council, by using Chapter 7, change the legal status of that territory, possibly or granting independence or something which will lead to independence? Likewise, you ask the question, can the Security Council create international tribunals which have authority over individuals? And my answer is A. Theoretically, yes, Chapter 7 is open-ended in these directions. The Council is told that it has to act consistent with the purposes and principles of the UN, which are spelled out in the first two articles of the Charter. And they include not only preserving peace, but also sovereign equality of states and self-determination and a number of other things. So what happens when these considerations might conflict? As you could argue, they would conflict in the case of Kosovo if the Council decided it was necessary to preserve the peace by giving independence to part of some state's territory. And the only answer I can come up with is that the Charter gives the Council the authority and responsibility of finding how to reconcile those competing considerations, which leads me to conclude that there may be circumstances in which the council can exercise this authority to change the legal status of some ways of a territory if it finds it necessary to preserve the peace, but it's very clear that the council needs to be extremely careful in exercising such authority not to strain the bounds of what is acceptable to the international community. And the same, I think, goes for international prosecutions. Now, you asked the obvious question, well, this is all fine and good for the United States because it has the veto, and presumably the other permanent five are similarly placed. Yes, that is a fundamental aspect of the system created by the Charter. The permanent five have fallback authority that the others do not in the exercise of the veto power. This was the political reality of the system created by the Charter, because only with the preservation of that possibility were these great powers prepared to accept the responsibilities of the system. You may wish to argue that that's unfair. It is reality. And I suppose the United States, of course, would always insist on preserving that system. So what do we have? I think my answer to your questions is yes, the Council can do these things. The Charter does give that authority, but it's an exercise that has to be extremely cautious, and overstepping would be a serious mistake.
Mm-hmm. Ruth, John?
If I could just comment on the on the Kosovo point. My next politically incorrect op-ed was going to gently talk about Kosovo. And there I'd be very careful. I mean, no, without blinking at all at what Serbia did in Kosovo, which was a very terrible instance of ethnic cleansing and crazy activity and trying to push hundreds of thousands of people over the border. But two things give me pause. One is, indeed, I can't think of another instance in which the council has torn up a country. And Kosovo was carved out as an autonomous province of Serbia in the 1947 constitution by Tito, who wanted to limit Serb power. But it did have co-equal status in the rotating presidency of the Yugoslav Federation. But it is still part of Serbia. And one would have to take the position that the commission of a genocidal act or an act of ethnic cleansing per se was sufficient to exercise the power of territorial division. People do that in the wake of world wars. Take Sudeten Germans out of Sudetenland and recarving the Polish-German border. But it's indeed, I think it's more than caution that is required. It's not a routine power. And what gives me some pause just from consistency is that two things. One is that when the recognition of the breakaway republics in Yugoslavia was engaged in 1991 and 2, it was in the face of the European Union's conclusion that, as they put it, Yugoslavia has already dissolved. They didn't say, we're dissolving it. They said, it's already dissolved. We're just recognizing the fact of the matter. And secondly, the European Union and Badinter, Robert Badinter, the old Conseil Constitutionnel hero of France, said there are minimum conditions now for recognizing a new state. It's not just territory, population, allegiance, and the capacity to conduct foreign relations. You also got to have ethnic minority rights, rule of law, democracy, and due process of law. And from the Alaska, I worship at the shrine of Soren Jessen Peterson, who's one of the great international civil servants, mm-hmm. and an old friend. But UNMIC and KFOR, despite Soren's efforts, was largely powerless to cure the situation in Kosovo. And if you look at the Serb minority, the March 04 ethnic violence was very troublesome and hasn't really been fully prosecuted. And any belief that the old monasteries would be safe in the wake of an international withdrawal is wishful. So I do think that this is one instance in which, despite one's sympathy for how the Kosovar Albanians were treated by the Serbs, that we have to be very careful about the precedential impact of what we would otherwise do in the council. Also, once you're out, you're out. You can't just intervene willy-nilly in a sovereign state. So giving a state sovereignty means something. It's not suzerainty, it's sovereignty. And therefore, you will lose most of your right to international presence if you're concerned about other problems in the region. And I have heard it speculated, I would not join in this thought, of course, that be careful what you wish for, be careful of the play within the play. Serbia joins Europe, Europe wants Serbia, but cutting out Kosovo, what does that mean? Map it onto Turkey. There can be a game within the game. Europe doesn't want Turkey. If Kosovo comes into Europe as part of Serbia, that has implications for Turkey. So don't assume always that every debate is on the up and up, despite people's self-hypnosis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let me pick up on that, yeah. too, because I think the other fear I have often is something like the ICC can become politicized. For instance, when it started, the presumption was the Serbs are guilty of everything. Well, I've dug up enough graves with dead Croats in them, and Serbs, and Bosniaks, to know that all sides did this. I would have been a lot more comfortable early on if Goldstone had said, all right, I want three Serbs, a Croat, and a Bosniak. We'll try those. Then we'll do three more Serbs, two a Croat and a Bosniak, rather than the Serbs are totally guilty, and we're the only ones. Also, this issue of, you know, that we have, I think, as Americans, we're authorized a swift and speedy trial by a jury of our peers. Does the state, this state, have the right to abrogate, cede that authority on my behalf to an international organization? Am I being tried by a jury of my peers? What law am I using here? Because they used to confuse the hell out of me. Am I using English common law? Am I using Napoleonic law? Where do the judges from international tribunals come from? What is their historical tradition in terms of rule of law, rules of evidence, sentencing procedures? So these things I think really have to be looked at much more carefully, because I'll tell you what happens then. When we started with the ICC, I went to Tudra. Now, we brought in, remember, in Eastern Slavonia, we arrested the first indicted war criminal, Slavko Dugmanovic. We took him to The Hague in June of 1996. Then I went to Tudra and I said, Mr. President, I've got one of them now. This is a man who is responsible for taking 200 Croatian wounded military personnel out of a hospital, systematically slaughtering them. Most of them now are in the Hague, Slavonjanin, Kirtic, and Russell. But I said, there are other people here who are also killers. Goran Hadžić, the president of the Republic of Ukraine. You've got the tapes, you've got the evidence, you've got the intercepts, give them to me. We'll pick him up and send him to the Hague. And Tudjman said, well, if I participate in this, am I not actively stating that I support the process of international tribunals and accept their legal authority, and therefore wouldn't help me? Wouldn't help me to get a Serb who had killed Croats. 2 months later, I was in Belgrade with Milosevic. Exactly the same thing. I said, there's a Croat in eastern Slavonia named Merchant who slit the throats of any number of Serbs and threw them in the Danube. You've got the evidence. You've got the intercepts. You've got the testimony. Give it to me. And he said exactly the same thing. By participating in this process, we acknowledge that the international tribunal has the authority, etc., etc. But I think you have to explain all these things a bit more carefully when you start out. In the case of Sierra Leone, that was a special case. When I got to Liberia, 230,000 people were killed by someone. And I called our prosecutor up there, and I said, David, does your mandate extend to Liberia? No. I said, can you and I work something out so we can expand it? Can't be done. This is a special relationship with the council. Can we establish a separate court in Liberia? No one's interested. And no one was interested. By that, I mean the foreign ministers of Ghana, Nigeria. We want nothing around here for 10 or 15 years. We don't want any more turbulence. We don't want money to water. We don't want to open no wounds. You know, let sleeping dogs lie. So those are all kinds of dilemmas that you have. But the main thing is, what kind of law are you using? Whose law are you using? I'm not sure what they're going to try Taylor on. What are they using now? They're going to try him in The Hague somewhere. Who's going to try him? I think they should have tried him in Sierra Leone, because otherwise now you'll have white man's justice. You took him out of Africa to be tried by judges. Well, I'm sure there'll be three African judges probably ultimately on that panel. But those kinds of things have to be thought through a little more carefully before we launch off and do these things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you. Ruth had mentioned Soren Justin Peterson, who I announced at the beginning of the panel, who was originally scheduled to appear but wasn't able to. He did read the book and communicated some of his ideas about it. I'll just convey those to you before asking a question or two, and then we'll close at 11:30.
I'm sorry. Could I just address a couple of points?
Go ahead.
The question of what laws being applied by the international criminal tribunals. The tribunals for Yugoslavia and Rwanda are applying international law, that is to say, a body of law that is, in fact, even now being developed, but has a lot of antecedents in Nuremberg and Tokyo and so on, with respect to the definition of the international crimes and the elements of those crimes. And in the negotiation of the ICC statute, there was a lot of negotiation about exactly what elements go into each crime. But he's quite right that that's only the first step, that the next step is what system are you going to apply to actually run the trials? There was a lot of trial and error because since the United States was one of the primary creators of the Yugoslav Tribunal, we sort of assumed we would start using an Anglo-American system of jurisprudence in terms of how the trials go and what the responsibilities of the courts and prosecutors are. But you can see in the International Criminal Court that they are beginning to adopt civil law procedures and styles as well. Mm-hmm. So the modalities are an evolving process. But the basic law that the tribunals are applying is a body of international law, which is in the process of development.
Well, that was just final thoughts with that.
Sure, no, please,
but
please.
It's a very incomplete law. When this is the man, this is the pistol-packing mama. what arrested Duke Manovich said it couldn't be done. Don't buy a ham sandwich from this guy. because my lay account is Duke Manovich says, can I come see my property in eastern Slavonia, and am I free from arrest? And some people say, we won't arrest you. They arrested you. so the question was whether an international court would allow this. It was a, it was a somewhat... forward-leaning account of contract law. And I didn't know how it would come out, frankly. I thought the European judges on the tribunal were likely to kick the case. They didn't. Mm-hmm. A great surprise. And even now, if you ask people, Goldstone says he wouldn't have done it, Cassese says it's okay, you don't get consensus on very important doctrines of making a legal
system. Which makes it very hard for the operator in the field to
Or ditto Charles Taylor. Chapter 6 tribunal, so it doesn't have this coercive power of Chapter 7. Taylor, technically, when he was arrested, was still ahead of state, or when he was indicted, was still ahead of state. Can you do that? So I do think when you have instances where the council is itself doing things the state couldn't do, where there is a clearly established doctrine of international law, the council does have to be cautious because people will copy the council, and it really is a jurisdictive generative organ in doing what it does.
But rest assured, Dugmanovich was guilty.
Oh, okay.
And to show you the power of suggestion, he was, after the trial had ended, he was visited by a delegation from Belgrade who said, you're a Serb, you will not be the first Serb convicted of war crimes. You know what you need to do. And in short order, we're going to have the feast of St. John, et cetera, and you will do the right thing. And he did the right thing. He hung himself in his cell.
Could I just say that Ruth is quite right that this this international law process of prosecution is a work in progress and is not quite complete. But I think it's important to say that one of the important things that the tribunals for Yugoslavia and Rwanda have done, maybe the most important thing, is to begin to develop this system in a very detailed way. And it's clear that the International Criminal Court, the permanent tribunal, is going to be relying heavily upon the this jurisprudence and this set of precedents that have been or are now being created by the two ad hoc tribunals.
Please.
Yeah, I'm Ken Yates, the Justin Waterman International. I'm an old New Englander, and I remember the UN in the old days when I was a kid, and it had the presence of a new hope, a new structure, a new idea that was needed. But it scares me now when I see the details, and it's sort of like a sweater. You pull a little thread, the whole thing comes apart. And in this case, the UN hires, when there's a problem, a set of experts. They're convened in panels, and they're sent someplace. And these experts have immunity, where you can't challenge them. You have no process that applies to them. They can say anything and charge anything they want, and it sticks. There's no way to remove it. In the case is Liberia, and the panel of experts went out there to investigate before the sanctions were imposed, and they came up with lists of people to be included on the sanctions list for no travel. And while much of it was very well applied and logical and deserved, there were pieces that weren't, because the experts were not quite as expert as we might have wanted. They sort of went out and collected rumors, innuendo, and stories, and brought them back and made a list. And when that list was released, it had a lot of people on there that really shouldn't have been on there. Now, if you're a person who's on one of those lists, you're in real big trouble. Because you, first off, you lose your business. You can't go anywhere and travel internationally. And you have no recourse. There's no legal rights that are defensible. You have no rights. And the experts who are hired to go dig up all these rumors and innuendo are immune to any kind of charges or any kind of countersuits or anything that might challenge the facts that they are using. I wonder is this something that is the same problem with sovereignty on the higher levels, but gets down to the individual, you get a real chill in your spine when you think of what can be done. I mean, can I be charged by some guy who doesn't know me, who walks in and somebody says something about me and he takes it to New York and puts my name on a list, and then I'm, from that point on, destroyed professionally, personally, and I can't do anything about it. I don't know what the answer is. I don't know if there is a right there. Is there? He's got a lawyer, the guy I know, who stoutly defends his integrity and his honesty, but he cannot get out from under the burden of the UN rules and regulations, which provide immunity to experts, and there is no legal recourse for him.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Go ahead.
Well, there's been an awful lot of attention to the problem of due process with respect to the operations of the sanctions committees. In which there has been a lot of valid criticism that it has, at least in the past, been perfectly easy to put somebody on a list of sanctioned entities, but he has relatively little due process to get off. And I think there have been some attempts by the Council to provide more due process, but I think a lot more needs to be done in that respect. The problem about experts traveling to foreign countries is that obviously, you don't want them to be subject to reprisal action by in the countries they go to, or they wouldn't be able to operate effectively. So that you do have a dilemma there. And then, you know, congressmen can say anything they want on the floor of Congress. Could be defamatory in character, and you can't really do anything about that, too. So it's really a weighing of preserving the integrity and possibility of these people doing their job against the possible negative consequences of irresponsible behavior. I don't have a magic formula.
But I think it is fair to say, the Council has been taking on jobs that require an administrative intricacy that it just doesn't have the capacity to do. And nobody has grown up a new division of Security Council administrative support. So whether it's oil for food in the inability to really look at the contracts and the kickback scheme for Saddam, or the issue of sanctions due process, they're really... All this just happened, and the Council began to form committees to do all these different things, which have some secretariat support, but they haven't really thought through the kind of adjudicative mechanism that you would need to, which you'd be familiar with if you were doing this as an APA, Administrative Procedures Act kind of challenge. On the other hand, if you want sanctions, they've got to be multilateral. And the UN itself doesn't have intelligence sources. It's dependent on its member states. And if it's really sensitive source, people won't give it to the UN and certainly won't open up the source's methods. So we get back into this unhappy world of ours where we sort of half know things but don't know them to a fairly well certainty, such as we would want in federal district court. And then what do you do?
It's interesting to compare, in the case of Iraq, the oil for food program with the UN Compensation Commission, which in many ways were dealing with the same volume of financial resources and flows, in essentially the same, many of the same circumstances, the one rife with scandal and corruption, the other apparently not. What is the difference? In part, it's because the one attempted to rely upon existing structures in the Secretariat and the Council, whereas the other created a new self-contained body which had its own rules and its own professional staff. It leads me to conclude that until we are able to reform the secretary, maybe we have to think about creating independent structures within the overall umbrella of the council.
I think Ken raised a very good point, because I would say a third of the names on that list were probably put there by informants, people getting even. It's what happened in France. I grew up in France. So France after the war, you know, there were many more French resistance fighters in 1946 than there were in 43. And all the Vichyites very quickly started turning in other people in hopes of covering their own dirty tracks. That's what happened in Liberia. It's the same name. And quite often, as he said, when we said this is not this person, but how the hell, no one, there's no mechanism for getting the person off the sanctions list. And yet other people, and that's the fallacy here, other people, let's say ministers of defense, who clearly were Taylor people, who brought in 22 tons of arms on 5 August 2003, which we seized, were suddenly taken off the sanctions list because, quote, they were cooperative with one of the major powers. Well, what the hell does that say about the rule of law, you know, to the rest of the population, or the validity of sanctions?
Mm-hmm. Okay. We're getting close to 11:30. I'd like to ask the panelists if they have any concluding remarks to make them, and but particularly in regard to the future of the UN Security Council's legal authority. If I can interject my own question here, I'm curious, now that Russia and China have really gained a voice on the council, can we continue to expect an increase in the expansion of legal authority, and you know, also with an eye towards a possible reform of the UN, what kind of an impact might that have on the council's legal authority? So if you have time to consider those questions, great. If not, I'd love to hear some of your concluding remarks.
I think energy politics is the new Cold War in the UN. I mean, against Sudan and Iran. China's huge interest in Africa is going to really cripple the council, I'm afraid. Well, how should we say? Modify the resolution of the vectors. Mm-hmm. But and therefore you're going to have lots more dilemmas where the council is going to be incapacitated and you have to decide what to do about what you feel morality or legality compels. On Jacques' point also, just if I may seg that in, whenever you do something, it's going to be very rough justice with a lot of bricolage and collateral damage, and I don't know any way around that. Even the Iraq Claims Commission has had, you know, problems of double claiming, that Iraq itself didn't have the right to challenge certain kinds of claims. It's very hard to be a government. It's very hard to recreate the richness of process and commitment that you expect in a nation state. And even some of the claimed success stories, dare I lament, now being looked at more critically, weren't successes at all. East Timor is now... It's busting apart for a reason. All these young men with nothing to do. There was early on a economics minister who turned away foreign investors. And one of my wonderful students at SAIS is writing a thesis on what she calls premature sovereignty in the sense that the rush to get out of there and to return it to local control meant that you had a Marxist who didn't like foreign investors who turned them all away, so you couldn't have pearl farming and fish farming on the reefs, which is one of East Timor's few assets. So I think, you know, sometimes we claim success because we need it for the Congress. East Timor was stipulated as a success to get the dues package through. But in fact, if you look at the aftermath of East Timor, it's pretty tough for the folks that live there. So we have to, I think, I've always call it tough love, call it gritty realism, call it what you want. But glossing over these problems doesn't do anybody any good. There's no reason to have the Tower of Babel in missions. There's no reason to have international administration when regional administration would get you some greater coherence and some common operating language. And in that sense, I do think that the sentimentality that too often accompanies the moniker of the UN is going to be the very thing that destroys it. And what you need, in my book, is more... The two gross safeguards are more voluntary funding, because then you get a better feedback loop, and what I dare to trademark as competitive multilateralism, that the UN really has to show why it's the multilateral organ to do something when you could otherwise
claim some measure of legitimacy from NATO plus, NATO plus Australia, New Zealand, and Japan, or other multilateral settings where it's not just the U.S. acting alone.
Mm-hmm. On the issue, in other words, I think most people don't realize 50% of UN peacekeeping missions fail after 5 years. Mm-hmm. It's a tragedy in a way. And obviously you do need reform. Now, the first dilemma you have is the whole notion of a Secretary General. The five permanents do not like strong Secretary Generals, right? These are a challenge to them. You don't want a Dag Hammarskjöld who actually makes policy, initiates, reacts. You don't want that. You want someone who's a quiet corporate executive who does what he's told by the council. As far as the whole panoply up there, the analogy I like to use when I look at all the other UN agencies, a squirrel in a cage full of nuts is quite often what I see. Absolute, this kind of chaotic mess. So what you do, you find individuals who are credible that you can work with and deal with. You try to forget about the nepotism and cronyism and those who are totally incompetent, yet are sitting in senior jobs that you have to work through or around. But this can all be done. What's lacking up there is a critical dialogue. There's a lack of honesty. People are afraid to say and speak the truth because it doesn't get you another job. And until you have an honest dialogue and say, doctor, patient, if you don't tell me what the hell is you think is wrong with you, I may be the best internist in the world, but I can only diagnose so much. So much more critical dialogue, constructive criticism, and a real plan for reform. Not these. There's an old J.B.S. Haldane, a British physicist, in the 19th century wrote once about theology. He said, so oft in theologic wars, the disputants I ween prate on about an elephant that none of them have seen. And that's what I get for a lot of the UN, people who study the UN, you know, criticize, who know really nothing about the dynamics of the organization. It's like someone having written the definitive work on the history of surgery from Galen to the present. And then you say, have you ever cut open anybody? No, I don't cut open. I critique those. I describe to you how to cut them open. I don't do that.
Okay, thanks. Mike, we'll give you the last word.
Well, just to try and answer your question about whether the resurgence of Russia and China within the Council is going to inhibit creative use of the Council's authority. And I think probably the answer is no. I mean, this is a phenomenon that began in the late 90s, but even in this period, we've seen the Council reach out in the case of international terrorism and weapons of mass destruction to global solutions for global threats. We've seen the Council on the verge of taking this step with respect to Kosovo about altering the status of a territory. We've had, I think, in the past few years, even more peacekeeping forces on the ground, even more exercises of Chapter 7 than we had in previous years. So it seems to me we have not exhausted the potential of the Council for trying to find creative new approaches to problems. The question is, can we do it sensibly?
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. I'd like to thank you all for coming today, and especially to thank our panel, Mike in particular, for giving us such a great book.
Buy the book.
Yes, the copies of the book are for sale out in our reception area, so please pick one up, and Mike will be available to sign copies as well. Thank you, and we hope to see you again soon.
I'll probably
want to
get back.
Hi there. Oh, you're the director. Deputy director.
Well, thank you very much for
this. You say it's going to be a bestseller, but I looked at Amazon the other day. I am number 105,400 on the list of Amazon one. Okay, so I need to have 500 friends.
Yeah, right. Very nice.